And we have with us James Corbett. James Corbett is the founder of the Corbett Report website. He lives in Japan. How's it going, James?
It's going pretty well. Thank you for having me on today.
Oh, glad to hear you. So what part of Japan are you in?
I'm on the western side of the main island, so about halfway between Osaka and Hiroshima.
Wonderful, wonderful. So let's talk about a couple of things. You've got the Corbett Report website. Talk about the Corbett Report website. What is it? Why would anybody ever want to go to the Corbett Report website?
I'm not sure I can answer that one. Great. I can tell them that this is a website I created 10 years ago. It's been up since July of 2007, and it was originally just the home for a podcast that I was starting at that time, but it's grown to include interviews and videos and articles and subscriber newsletters and all sorts of content. And I never in my wildest imagination believed or thought that I would ever start a website or would become a journalist of whatever sort that I am, but here I am, and I'm doing this for a full-time living now.
Wow, that's interesting. So, you know, you're running a website, you're a journalist, and there's an issue that we talk about here, you know, Lee and I talk about here a lot. Lee's been, an independent journalist. He's been a professional journalist with Breitbart. He's written for other sites. And, of course, you know, me here in Pacifica, I do a show, and I've done, literally probably hundreds of appearances on Fox News. The issue of media manipulation, and programming techniques for both the mainstream media and alternative media, I understand that's something that you have a concern with, one of the issues that you work on.
That's one of the primary reasons that I started the website, really, is just the vast disconnect, the information that we now have available directly at our fingertips on the internet versus what is reported in the mainstream news. And I saw that disconnect and was disgusted by it and thought, well, the only way to do something about it is to throw myself into that mix. So that's really the genesis of my website. I think more people are starting to see that or it's becoming more blatant than it ever has before, the things that we can find directly through social media and other things that that are not in accord with what's being reported on the TV news.
Great, yeah. You know, I think, that's an issue that comes up all the time. And it's really, particularly after the last election cycle, the primaries and the general election, I think more so than ever, people have somewhat lost faith in the media. I firmly believe this. Let me ask you what you think about this. I tell you, one of the times that I really think that this happened, and that was leading up to the Iraq war with all of the things that were going on with people started finding out that there were stories being planted by various, various entities in, say, the New York Times and major media outlets. And I think also we saw in the last, during the last election cycle, we saw the instances where there were stories being planted. I think that's one of the big things, personally, one of the big things that causes me to look at the media with such a jaundiced eye is finding out, when you find out that there are stories by politicians, by political entities, that there are people calling when something happens on a, when a story goes down on a media outlet that a particular politician doesn't like, that they're calling and complaining, and it seems like now that there's the media is being owned or manipulated by political entities, which means, is it really media anymore?
Well, you point out a lot of very important phenomena, and ones that have been going on for a very long time, even though they're just more and more evidence since the Iraq War. But if you go back to the first Gulf War back in the 1990s, you had the incubator babies testimony.
Yes.
Caught up in front of the UN and was pleading for help because the Iraqi army was throwing babies out of incubators and onto the cold hospital floor in Kuwait. And this is why we needed to go in and sort that out militarily. And of course, it turned out that not only was that false testimony, but it was actually false testimony that was set up by a PR agency in Washington. It was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador pretending to be a nurse. And the whole thing was completely fabricated, but it was one of the things that people I know myself and probably many other people who were alive at that time will remember about the first Gulf War, is the incubator baby story. And that's just one example of something that we see in the lead up to really all of these major military conflicts, these types of stories. I was just covering today on my program Back in 2011, during the Libya campaign, the NATO campaign, there was the story that was floated by the ICC prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, that that Gaddafi was giving Viagra to his troops in order to fuel rapes of the Libyan citizens. And this was one of the atrocities that NATO had to go in and sort out. Of course, that was dropped when it turned out there was absolutely no evidence whatsoever that that story was true, but it was reported breathlessly by the media at the time.
Now, so one of the things you talk about, like, so for instance, the most recent story, is your five people who you won't believe work for the CIA, is that your most recent story or just a recent story? It's pretty recent, right?
Yesterday, yes. Yeah.
So you've got a story up there about that, for instance. Now, you, and by the way, just can you name a couple, I don't want to tease people, we won't give away everything, but name a couple people who you won't believe work for the CIA, just so people know what the story.
The one that really fascinated me was Julia Child, because of course everyone thinks of cooking and souffles recipes and things when they think of Julia Child. But in fact, she was not just any agent. She was actually a pretty important person in the OSS, which was the forerunner to the CIA during World War II, working directly under OSS director William Wild Bill Donovan, the man who really started and founded the CIA. So that was kind of a surprising one to me. But one that I think is very apropos to this conversation is Arthur Sulzberger Sr., who people might know as the publisher of the New York Times from the 1960s to the 1990s. He was a willing and witting participant with the CIA in their Operation Mockingbird program in the 1960s and 70s. And that was exposed by Carl Bernstein in his landmark 1977 piece on the CIA and the media.
And we, as we know from Gloria Steinem, you know, she spoke openly about her work with the CIA and her relationship with the agency.
And it's interesting. The reason I brought that specific story, aside from the fact that it's recent, is that we're in a media era right now where the Trump-Russia narrative, for instance, right, that has been clearly fueled by, like, the Washington Post, the New York Times as well, but the Post has been leading the coverage on that. Ellen Nakashima, June 14th of last year, is the one who broke the story, blaming Russia for what they said was a hack of the DNC. And we know that a lot of their sourcing, because they say it, is unnamed intelligence sources. Now, Garland and I have talked a number of times about how Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon, who owns the Washington Post, Amazon is a big $600 million contract with the CIA. And we bring that up. Now, it's not a conspiracy. We'll talk about conspiracy theories with you in a minute. But that's not a conspiracy theory. To me, it's a clear conflict of interest that I don't see anybody talking about. You know, usually what you do is you say, even NPR does this. They'll say, they cover a story on Ford or whatever. They'll say, Ford is a sponsor of, I'm making that example up, but they'll say, Ford is a sponsor of NPR. I don't see that in the Washington Post. I'm missing the part where they mention frequently, hey, by the way, we have a $600 million contract. Do you, you know, someone who covers some of these issues, are you concerned about that?
Oh, clearly, yes. And as soon as you mentioned the Washington Post, that was the exact connection that I was going to bring up, the $600 million contract that Bezos has with the CIA. But don't worry, those are completely different and separate operations, completely separated business-wise. He has no conflict of interest. Now, of course, for anyone with their head screwed on straight can see that is a clear conflict of interest that is never obviously reported on by the Washington Post and never will be. And unfortunately, I don't think this is any startlingly new phenomenon. I think the idea of a single billionaire owning a large media company is the way of the future, increasingly, as we see a lot of billionaires coming along trying to snap up these media organizations to give an imprimatur to whatever they want to print, and Bezos being the shining example of that. But I think this is essentially the way this is generally functioned for decades and decades, demonstrably, with the Washington Post before it went over to Bezos when it was still with the Graham family, who, of course, attended the Bilderberg meetings every single year without ever reporting on the Bilderberg conference, if you want to talk conspiracy.
Well, once again, we're talking to James Corbett. He's the founder of the Corbett Report website. We're talking to James from Japan, which transitions us right to the next subject I think we ought to talk about. And nothing makes it more starkly clear than the Amazon CIA post-conflict, and that is the issue of business, government, tech, the relationship between all of those. So now we've got the Defense Department, which actually has a group in that is in an outlet that's in Silicon Valley that's given out like $100 million worth of contracts to these big tech like last year. So now we've got the relationship between business, government, tech, Google, Facebook, Amazon, et cetera. You know, what are your thoughts on the danger of that?
I think we're starting to see the danger of that very clearly, as obviously a few sites are now dominating the internet, at least in the English-speaking world. Obviously, Facebook and Google and YouTube and these other sites are sites where hundreds of millions of people congregate on a daily basis to share information. And that is an incredible amount of power in the hands of the people who are running these organizations. So there really does deserve to be a high level of scrutiny of who this is, because this is really, in a sense, though the Washington Post and New York Times may have been the papers of record decades ago, but at this point, it is Facebook and Google and YouTube where people are getting their information. Those are the papers of record, I suppose, for our day and age. And we're starting to see what the problems of that are when YouTube, for example, can decide who gets to monetize their videos or not monetize their videos because they're talking about controversial subjects, or who can get eliminated from the platform altogether because they're just simply being too controversial or not saying the right things. Obviously, that is an incredible amount of power to be wielding, and that means we have to be scrutinizing who are the people that are wielding this power and how did they come into these positions in the first place.
Well, and I don't, and I'm going to ask you a question. I don't know the answer to it, which is kind of the point, actually, which is, so you're here with us on 105.5 Radio Sputnik, and Sputnik and RT, both Russian-funded media outlets in the U.S., and worldwide, by the way, and worldwide, but they're coming under a lot of scrutiny. We talked to a reporter from Sputnik France yesterday who was saying that they, you know, Macron was banning them from press events, and we've had FCC, you know, FCC, FBI scrutiny apparently of these outlets. So how do you? So here's what I'm curious about: how do you view an outlet like Sputnik, like RT, and what do you make of the broad anti-Russia narrative that's come up in the U.S. Really in the past 8 months? It's really intensified since that Washington Post article came out. How do you make it? Again, I don't know the answer you're going to give, which is why I'm part of the reason of asking, because we've had people come on here and say anti-Russia stuff, and we don't stop them. That's the wacky thing about this show. We don't censor them. So I'm very curious just what your take is.
Well, as someone who comes at this from the online independent media space, this is where I am. This is how I operate. This is where I came from. I think what this new movement, this new journalism movement that's happening online represents is an awakening to the fact that there is no objective journalism. There is no such thing. That was an ideal that was put out there, I think, to placate the masses for a long time. The idea that there are some journalists floating around on clouds that can present both sides of an issue and let you decide, whereas in reality, absolutely everything about the presentation of information comes from an editorial perspective. Even choosing what to talk about and what not to talk about cannot be done objectively. There is a subjective process there. So I think the most important thing is for an outlet's biases to be there out front and for people to know what position this is coming from. I think that's the most important thing, because once you have that, then you can apply the appropriate filters to understand, you know, what information they're presenting and what might not be being presented, which is why I don't think fundamentally I have a problem with the state-funded media, Sputnik or whatever, operating in the sense that, well, okay, we know who is funding them. We know where it's coming from. It's when there is the pretense that there's something objective happening here, that these five or six major media corporations that own most of the media in the United States, these big companies, are not themselves beholden to their corporate interests or their political attachments, or that the BBC, for example, well, that's not a state-run media organization, whereas RT is, or something along those lines. I think those kinds of distinctions are ridiculous, and clearly this is in service of a geopolitical agenda. This isn't about scrutiny over the media or, oh, we must protect our innocent ears from this information. I mean, ultimately, if the United States believes in the First Amendment and what it means, then clearly people should not be afraid of people having the ability to broadcast their information and letting people decide. That's supposedly what this is all about, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. That's something we discuss often, and that is, number one, you know, our opinion is what's going on now, or what they're trying to do now, is somewhat akin to book burning, and they're saying, look, you know, our opinion is, look, people should be able to go to whatever website they want to go to, and that people are ultimately intelligent enough to make a decision as to what they believe or don't believe. But what we're getting now is this kind of elitist position that says, you know, you're too stupid to understand. You don't have the intellect that we elites have to understand what's good and bad, what's fake and real news. And so we may have just have to cut some of this stuff out so you can only get the official premise. And, you know, there are people, sites, you know, watch out, because now that you've gone on Radio Sputnik, you know, you could be in their crosshairs. But there are people now going after, on both sides of the aisle, going after websites that are outside of the mainstream, you know, calling them, you know, whatever, you know, fake news, et cetera.
Propaganda, yeah.
I'm already on those lists, on the proper not list, as Russian propaganda. That I really baffle me. I've never even set foot in Russia, so.
Well, if you, and what's so, you know, really insidious about this, if you think about the proper not list, what's so insidious about these things are they say, well, these people are working for Russia, or unwittingly, they're just saying things that, you know, Putin would probably like if he knew they were saying them. So they've, you know, taken it so far over the edge. But James Corbett, the founder of the Corbett Report website, great. We got plenty more to talk about. We'd like to get you back on again sometime, and we certainly appreciate you coming on with us. We'll be back next with Allison Galbraith, who's running for Congress in the state of Maryland. You're listening to Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan.
Fault Lines.